Let's end this hour with some thoughts on moving our bodies. We'll add some more music to our ultimate workout mix in a few moments. Now for some Tai Chi, the Chinese martial art involving slow and rhythmic movement. It benefits older people by maintaining balance and strength. And as NPR's Patty Naimond reports, researchers have found Tai Chi also helps people who suffer from Parkinson's disease.
For Leona Maracle, the first sign that she had a problem was the shaking. She was a math teacher.
The students began to notice that my hands were trembling. And so I started learning how to compensate by keeping that affected hand under the table and use my other hand, my non-dominant hand, to pass out papers and to interact with the students.
Pretty soon it became clear that Maracle couldn't give her best, so she retired at 67. That was 2 years ago, about the same time she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, a progressive disorder of the nervous system.
I would need to think two or three times about moving a particular part of my body. When I was sitting in a chair and wanted to get up, it took me two or three mental messages to go to my muscles to actually move my body.
Soon, Maracle had difficulty walking upstairs, downstairs, to the car, or just down the street. So when she heard the Oregon Research Institute was starting a study of Tai Chi to see if it helped Parkinson's patients, she signed up right away. The study was headed by research scientist Fusong Lee.
We push, we lean bodies forward, almost leaning towards our limits before you feel you need to take a step. And then recover.
Lee demonstrates a classic Tai Chi pose called Part the Wild Horse's Mane. He shifts from one foot to the other, a graceful zigzag, his arms also moving like scissors back and forth. As he shifts, he leans forward in order to practice and build balance, something most people can do without thinking.
For example, reaching out for an object, transitioning from seated to standing, or from standing back to seated.
In the study, Lee divided Parkinson's patients into three groups. One group did resistance training with weights, another stretching classes, and the third, Tai Chi. Each group participated in a 60-minute class twice a week for 6 months. When they finished, Lee found the Tai Chi patients were stronger and had much better balance.
4 times better than those patients assigned to stretching group, about 2 times better than those in the resistance training group in regards to improvements in balance.
And that led to significantly fewer falls for patients in the Tai Chi group. Leona Maracle says that before Tai Chi, she lost her balance 8 to 10 times a day. Now it hardly ever happens. She recently even saved herself from what would have been a sure fall before Tai Chi. It was raining and dark, and she tripped on the curb as she got out of her car.
Suddenly I have to make a little jump, which was unheard of before, but I kind of gave a little jump, and I brought my foot up above the curb and could steady myself on the ground next to the curb. That would have been a fall for sure 6 or 8 months ago.
Researchers don't know exactly how Tai Chi works to restore balance. UCLA brain scientist Dr. Michael Irwin says it may retrain areas of the brain that control movement.
There's a memory component of our nerves, and they're receiving signals from our body all the time that are integrated by the brain. And I think one of the things that happens with Tai Chi is it's bringing awareness of the brain to these areas of the body that we often sort of neglect, we sort of take for granted.
Things like balancing when we stand up or just walk. Now Irwin's researching other potential benefits of Tai Chi. Patty Naimond, NPR News.
Now let's go from scientific discoveries to a rapidly emerging market, China, which has a consumer market that is massive, 1.3 billion people. Breaking into that market is not easy. Some products from the United States, like donuts, have not done so well. But an old American sneaker has become a success. The Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star, which you may just call Chucks. NPR's Frank Langford explains how a cheap canvas basketball shoe became popular in the Middle Kingdom.
I'm walking along a side street in Shanghai around lunchtime. There are a lot of people out. And there's a woman walking along here wearing a pair of raspberry-colored Chuck Taylors. In fact, in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I've seen two other people wearing Chuck Taylors as well.
The girl with the raspberry sneakers is Shujing.
She's a 27-year-old who works for an ad company. I ask her why she likes the shoes.
They have a young image, upbeat and outdoorsy, sporty. Young people with an artistic sense prefer Converse.
Chen Xiaolei, Chu's co-worker, owns three pairs of Chuck Taylor high tops.
The shoes are pretty light, good-looking. They go with skinny jeans. Nowadays, young people like these shoes because they're fashionable.
Yes, fashionable. The canvas and rubber shoe that dates to 1917 Massachusetts is now considered reasonably cool among 20-somethings in Shanghai. Last year, about 5 million pairs of Chuck Taylors were sold in China, not counting all the fakes. It's not a huge number in this giant market, but it's up 50% from 2007. To understand the shoe's emerging popularity here, it's worth looking at how its image has morphed over time. The Chuck Taylor spent its first decades as a hoop sneaker.
Wilt Chamberlain has a shot at a 100-point game tonight. He's already broken his own record of 78 points in a game.
Then, in the 1970s, punk rockers adopted the shoe. The Ramones wore Chuck Taylors. As did Kurt Cobain of Nirvana in the 1990s. The shoe finally arrived in China in 1993, and Chinese rockers followed the fashion lead of American groups they admired. Yang Haisong sings with the Beijing indie band PK14. He's been wearing Chuck Taylors for years. Yang thinks they're popular because of their price and image.
It's quite cheap compared with other, like Nike, Adidas. And the second one, the reason is like it's people like to look back.
Fugu means retro in Chinese. And Chuck Taylors can sell for as little as $35 a pair, cheap by current standards. Until relatively recently, Converse licensed its brand here to a Taiwanese company that marketed the shoes as sportswear. In 2007, Converse took the brand back and began emphasizing a more casual, youthful image.
I'm Steve Parker. I'm the VP GM of Converse Asia Pacific.
Parker says the company partnered with street artists and built on existing influential customers like Yang Haisong. Converse underwrote a tour for PK14 and another Chinese band, Queen C Big Shark.
We put them on a bus and we traveled through, I think it was 9 different provinces, and it ended up in a big party and a show in Beijing right at the time of the Olympics.
Converse still gives Yang Haisong and his band free sneakers. But it also gets marketing help from people with whom it has no relationship. Kenny Lee runs MyT in Shanghai. It's a Converse store / museum with no connection to the company. Lee says he carries 1,300 different Chuck Taylors, including limited editions from Tokyo and New York. He shows me a two-tone shoe that fuses styles from the 1960s and the 1980s. I ask how much it costs.
This pair is priceless. Many people offered me $1,500 or $3,000, and I wouldn't sell. No matter how much money you offer, I'm not going to sell.
A potential customer, Zhu Lingling, walks in and looks at a fur-lined Chuck Taylor. Zhu used to wear the brand as a college student. She now designs cosmetics packaging and recently had a child.
Now that I work, I don't wear these shoes as often, but sometimes I still want to chase the memories of my college days.
Kenny Lee wants $160 for the shoes. Zhu says she loves them, especially the fur, but can't see paying that much for nostalgia. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
Now to a burgeoning soup movement here in the U.S. It's based on a simple recipe. Bring a bunch of people together to eat soup. Ask each person for a modest donation, say $5. Listen to proposals about how people might use that money for a good cause. And then finally, vote on the best proposal and give all the money to the winner. These soup groups have bubbled up around the country. In Philadelphia, an organization called Phila Soup concentrates on education. NPR's Linton Weeks takes us there for a bowl of tomato bisque.
On a recent Sunday night, about 45 members of the local education community gather at the University Barge Club Boathouse on the banks of the Schuylkill River. Phila Soup was founded by two sisters, Nika and Claire Landau, with help from their friend Jason Tucker.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming to Soup tonight. I'm Mika.
And I'm Claire. But we want to try and do a little roll call. If you are here from a charter school.
Here.
If you're here from a public school.
Here. Outside, it is icy cold. Inside, the room is warmed by a gas fire and conversation. On the wall, a huge moose head, its antlers hung with Christmas lights.
We're really hoping that Phyllis Soup will be a monthly micro-grant dinner that starts and ends with teachers, but is an access point to education for the whole city.
On the menu, four soups, all donated. Lentil, tomato bisque, beef barley, and ginger carrot. As people slurp their last spoonsful, Claire Landau goes over the rules.
The way it's going to work is that we'll have three presenters from three different schools who are doing great projects that they would like you to fund tonight with our micro grant. They're going to have 3 minutes to present, and then after
and then,
3 minutes,
as dessert is served, everyone will vote on the best proposal. To the winner will go about $225.
So let's see who would like to go first.
Lacey Boland, a seventh grade English teacher, steps to the front. She talks pretty fast.
Okay, so I'm just going to start with the reading. This is a story from Snow White the Remix.
Lacey's students have written new versions of the old fairy tale and turned them into books.
There's something wrong with her, the doctor sighed. The mother was in a daze. She let out a small mix between a scream and a gasp. Every time
a professional writer came in to help. Lacey wants some money to do it again.
It's impossible to underestimate the power that just him being in the room and working one-on-one with them in a large group. So I'm hoping to get funding to help bring him for at least one visit back to our classroom.
Next is Brian Kerner, an art teacher at Prep Charter High School.
For years, I came up with an idea for a metals project because, well, metals are cool.
So Brian wants to buy art supplies so his students can make medieval shields that reflect meaningful parts of their lives. He's teaching them about symbolism in art. The last presenter is Alyssa Boyle, the energetic principal at Camelot XL North Academy. Her students wear uniforms, and Alyssa wants to reward those who have good attendance records by giving them black vests.
Any way to make their uniform a little more snazzy is always welcome. And then that will just sort of send a message out through the rest of the school that you can become eligible for these vests and you can be proud of what you've accomplished. So that's why I'm here tonight. Thank you.
After the three proposals, a plate of cookies is passed around. Jason hands out small stones and tells everyone to vote for the project they like the best by putting their stone into milk jugs. There's a jug for each proposal. Once the crowd has voted and left, and the soup is put away, Jason and the Landau sisters do the tally.
I think we have a
winner.
And the winner is Lacey Boland, Fairy Tale Remixed. Linton Weeks, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
As the candidates modulate their messages, they keep an eye on changing economic numbers. One of those numbers is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's our most common barometer of the economy, and the Dow just broke a four-year high, by the way. But as Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team reports, it doesn't tell you much.
You hear it so often, it's just the background noise of your day.
The Dow gained more than 156 points to close at 12,862.
So the Dow went on a run today, up 339.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average down fractionally about 17 points, finishing the day at 12,845.
That was Scott Pelley of CBS News, Brian Williams of NBC News, Maria Bartiromo of CNBC. They've all read the Dow's latest moves. I should say I've done it myself. We use the Dow to constantly check the temperature of the economy. A lot of people, maybe most people, don't even know what the Dow is. Well, it's just the stock price of 30 big American companies summed up and roughly averaged. That's it. And what does the daily movement of this number have to do with the lives of most Americans? Not much.
In 2011, well, we had days where it would go up several hundred points, and then the next day it would go down several hundred points. You can't really argue that the mood and outlook of the entire country was changing that rapidly.
This is John Prespo. He's one of the leading critics of the obsessive way the Dow is covered in the media, which is surprising because he's the editor and executive director of Dow Jones Indexes. We asked him how often he checks the Dow.
Not every day, and I'm one of the people responsible for it.
He says the Dow Jones average is great for a very specific purpose, to get a long-term sense of how the leading U.S. companies are doing. But its moment-by-moment or even day-by-day movements are pretty much meaningless. In fact, the guy truly responsible for it, Charles Dow, who created it in 1896, Prespo says Charles Dow didn't bother to comment on his own metric more than once a month. So what happened? How did we develop this 24-hour fixation on the Dow? Well, we panicked.
The panic of 1907.
Prespo points out that 1907 was a lot like now. A severe recession, banks were collapsing, everybody was trying to make sense of a disastrous economy. They wanted some handy metric that could tell you clearly, in an instant, what each day's news meant.
So they looked around and they found the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It took on a life of its own, shall we say.
Newspapers started referring to it. Then, during the Great Depression, it became a daily requirement. Now, of course, we can follow it every second of the day, which might satisfy that same need. We are still confused, and we want to know what the latest scary or hopeful economic news means. So we look around, and there's still this one thing available. It always has an answer for us, even if the answer doesn't actually mean anything. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
This week, NPR music critic Ann Powers has been telling us about tunes that are in contention for the Grammy Song of the Year, including this.
This is Mumford & Sons with their song, The Cave. So tie me to a post and block my ears. I can see where those orphans threw my tears. And know my cold despite my faults and despite my growing fears. If you watched the Grammys last year, you might remember the band during the telecast. This British folk rock band wasn't that well known across America before last year's performance. But right after it, their sales went way up, more so than any of the other acts on the show. They didn't even win anything that night. 'Cause I have other things to fill my time. You take what is yours and I'll take mine. Now let but did Mumford's Grammy performance give the song enough of a bump that it had a second life? The Grammys do cultivate their own stars, and Mumford's trajectory exemplifies that. So I'm going to go with yes.
That's NPR music critic Ann Powers, and tomorrow she'll be back for a fuller look ahead to the Grammy Awards, which are coming on Sunday.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Next month marks 1 year since a massive earthquake and tsunami struck northeast Japan, causing a meltdown at a coastal nuclear plant. The region, known as Tohoku, is a prime producer of seafood, miso paste, and sake. But concerns about food safety after the meltdown have hampered its recovery. As Lucy Kraft reports from Tokyo, one of the world's leading experts on Japanese food, an American woman, is now lending a hand.
It's a nihaizu, or a vinegar sauce on top of it.
If there's a Julia Child of Japanese cooking classes, a witty and passionate interpreter of Japan's cuisine, transplanted New Yorker Elizabeth Ando would fit the bill nicely.
But the color is less vibrant. It's just embarrassingly simple. I'll explain it to you in a moment.
As an exchange student back in the 1960s, the former Elizabeth Sachs came to Japan to pursue anthropology. She fell in love, but not just with a local businessman. Her life has been devoted to parsing and explaining the finer points of Japanese cuisine to the rest of the world as writer for Gourmet magazine, cookbook author, and culinary teacher in suburban Tokyo.
You can just pull off a piece and see what it's like.
After the triple disaster struck Tohoku last year, Ando was in a quandary. Slowed by illness, she focused on raising money for what she does best, publishing a cookbook. But this book, instead of her usual lavish coffee table tome, would be shorter and published only online. Ando's mission is to help save Tohoku by documenting its obscure regional cuisine.
There's a physical diaspora, if you will. There are evacuees that are still, unfortunately, in temporary housing. Some of them have been physically moved to other parts of Japan.
Regional cuisines are a moving target. Traditional dishes often disappear during periods of upheaval, like right now.
So there's the sense of urgency that I feel before it gets too assimilated, that people will be able to share with me their food memories so that I can get it out there to a larger audience.
Chilly and remote, with both mountains and a long coast, Tohoku cooking draws heavily on foodstuffs dating back 5,000 years.
Much of it is quite ancient. The area itself goes back to the Jomon period. We're talking about, you know, millennia. And some of the foodstuffs that I've tried to sort of give a new life to, the seeds, the nuts, the dried flowers, they're not things that normally people would think of using in their kitchen.
Ando's cookbook includes delicacies such as walnut and miso-stuffed herb leaves, enoki mushrooms with dried chrysanthemum petals, and persimmons in pine nut sauce. But the cover of her ebook displays just three rice balls, the Japanese equivalent of a peanut butter sandwich.
Because it travels well and doesn't have to be reheated, it became the first food that survivors ate. That's the whole point. It's comforting because it's recognizable. It's the thing that you want when everything else around you is falling apart.
Ando's book, Kibo, Brimming with Hope, is being released this month in digital form only, with half the proceeds going to the recovery of Tohoku. For NPR News, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.